Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have asked Tinica to read a portion of Chapter 3 of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
I'm an alcoholic. More about alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 30 and 31. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholics. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wine, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list infinite.
Thank you. This is a speaker meeting. Sarah will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Peter, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. I'd like to introduce Sarah. Yeah, what do you want? Like a minute or what?
Yeah.
10. I can do that.
Hi, my name's Sarah and I'm an alcoholic. We're really nervous. This is like the biggest meeting I've ever chaired at. So I'll give you a little bit about where I'm at now before I go into experience, strength, and hope. I am 2 weeks away, higher power willing. I'll have 8 months. And I have a sponsor. I'm on my eighth step. I finally finished my list and wrote the objectives down. So when I meet with my sponsor, I'll be on my ninth step. I go to a meeting, sometimes two, every single day. I have two sponsees. I have two service commitments. And I pray every day. So, since I am short on time, I'm just going to give a short little story about how bad I was. And this was pretty close to my rock bottom. I would get a ride to a party by asking, like, some dude, and he usually thought he was my boyfriend, but he wasn't, and, or one of them, and so I would get a ride there, and drugs are part of my story, so if you have a problem with that, call your sponsor. So I would, you know, drink, and I would use, and I eventually would run out, and I would, like, have this little internal panic attack, like, oh my god, there's no more. And I knew all the drug dealers, so I would walk up to the drug dealer and be like, hey, I don't have money, but, like, can you give me some stuff? He would tell me, well, you know what you have to do, and I'd be like, well, I can't, I have dude over here. But, you know, see those three pretty girls? They're my friends. So, like, I can try talking to them to do the deed for me. And I would get the, like, okay, that's cool. So I'd walk up to my pretty friends and be like, hey, anyone think he's cute? He's a rad guy. And I would say anything. I was so selfish. I didn't care about my friends. I would say anything to get them to say yes. I would even lie and say that this guy's safe. And I'd walk up to the guy, I'd be like, okay, so I'll introduce you, but we have to go to the bathroom, do a few lines, and I'll get my stuff and go. And that would happen. I would introduce them, and then I would leave the party immediately before she could change her mind, because if I'm gone, I'm no longer responsible. That was my logic thinking. And I would wake up the next morning, hungover, feel a little guilty, so I'd call her up and be like, hey, let's go get lunch on me, try to, like, clean my side of the street. Well, I would take her to McDonald's. And then I would tell her she can buy anything she wants off the dollar menu. Because I still needed money to get chicken tenders. And that was me. That I was so selfish and self-centered, and I didn't care who I was going to hurt. And it, my addiction progressed, and it took me to the point where I didn't even care if I was going to get hurt. All I cared about was my next drunk or my next high. And it took a lot for me to get in these rooms, although I got in here really young. I was raped, I was beaten, I had my stuff stolen from me, I was in abusive relationship after abusive relationship because it made me feel better that someone was more fucked up than me. And eventually I had enough, and I couldn't take it anymore. I didn't want to get 5150'd again. So I went to Diamond Links Monday nights, 8 p.m., and in my opinion, that's one of the best meetings. And I shared, you know, I think it's really cruel to not warn people, like, hey, we're going to pass in a sign-in sheet, and if they call your name, you're going to share, because they called my name, and I was like, I'm right here, that's me. That was like roll call. And I got a sponsor that night, and she was great. She was very spiritual, and that's exactly what I needed for the first three steps. So that's exactly what I needed for the first three steps. She was amazing, and I found a higher power that was suited me. Like, it didn't have to be the God from my grandma's church, and I love that. I really had to separate religion from spirituality. And then, since she was so sweet and so nice, I was just afraid to be honest. I was afraid to tell her about my past. So I switched sponsors, and I jumped into the fourth step. And I really got a new perspective on myself. I realized that I'm not a victim. I had a part in just about every single situation I put myself in, even if it was just showing up. And halfway through my fifth step, I was so tired of myself. I was like, can you just shut up? You're, like, full of shit. Can I cuss you? The sixth and seventh step is really just, like, keeping me in check. Like, I thought the seventh step was like, okay, I'm going to memorize this prayer, and then we're good. And that's not the seventh step. Like, I have to constantly turn my character defects over to my higher power, and I pray for situations to be presented to me so I can handle them differently than I would in the past. And in the eighth step, before I could even write my list, I had to forgive myself for the things I did. And that was hard. That took a lot of praying, a lot of cat cuddles, but I got there. And now I don't even recognize that person 8 months ago. I don't even know who she is. I can look at myself in the mirror and not spit at my reflection, and I think that's amazing. I think it's amazing for any alcoholic, any person to be able to do that. And I have two sponsees now, and having sponsees is an eye-opener. I meet each of them separately an hour, and every day works best for both of us. And I spend that hour not thinking or talking about myself. And that, I never did that before. All I did was talk about myself. Like, I would listen to you, but I would wait to talk about myself. Like, okay, can I talk about myself now? Or now? Or how about now? And then they call me, you know, frequently. And that's 5 to 30 minutes of not talking about myself and hearing about their problems. And I feel honored that they're sharing these stories with me, their experiences with me. And they're such beautiful women. And AA has really changed my life. Like, I've... friend of mine likes to say to get in the middle of the herd, and that's the best thing you can do. You know, when you get into the AA community and you meet people and you make sure that they know you, like, and really talking to people and listening to their experiences and listening to their opinions, because you'll be doing something and you're like, oh wait, so and so said this, like, I get it now. And you know, when I got sober, like, to the newcomers, I had a lot of women tell me that men are predators in AA and they're all sick. And that's not true. Like, we're all sick. That's why we're here. You know, like, healthy, emotionally stable people don't walk into this room. And I've met some amazing men in these rooms. I've met some amazing women in these rooms. I've just met amazing people. And by putting myself out there and not having this prejudice against a certain race, a certain gender, I've really been able to build amazing relationships. And men have saved my ass when I thought I was going to drink, and women have saved my ass when I thought I was going to drink. And I just think that's amazing, because before sobriety, I was afraid of everyone. I didn't leave my room. And it's not like that anymore. And my relationships with my family has changed. You know, my mom, she answers my calls now, and I'm in her wedding. I'm a bridesmaid. I'm giving a toast, and that in itself feels really great, because, you know, she didn't even want me to come home when I was out. And I'm in a great relationship. I'm not getting abused, and I'm not abusing him. That's, like, mind-blowing. I thought, like, everyone was mean to each other. And I have friends who care about me, and I have friends I actually care about. And I know this program has really just changed my perspective on the world. Like, I wake up in the morning and I start my day off with prayer. And not everything is perfect, but I'm happy. And I was never happy before. You know, I have privileged problems, and I'm happy I have privileged problems. Like, I have to worry about going grocery shopping with money I have to buy groceries. I have to worry about paying my Comcast bill on time with money I have to pay the Comcast bill. You know, I'm just really grateful. Like, I tell my sponsees that, like, I really hope you stick around, and I really hope you work these steps, even if it's not with me. But if you do, then a few months down the road, you're going to look at yourself and not even recognize who you are. And that's the best thing this program has given me, that I don't even recognize that person that gets me to continue to go to meetings, because I want to not continue to not recognize her. I want to continue to grow. I want to continue to better myself, and I want to continue to help people. And this is the perfect program to do that. If you are honest and if you're willing. Honesty, like, it's hard. It's really hard to be, like, a pathological liar and then be honest. But it keeps me sober, even if it hurts. Even if it hurts me or another person, I have to be honest. And, so thank you for hearing me speak.
Okay. Hi, my name's Peter. I'm an addict and an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
And I'm going to try and project, because normally I talk like this. And I hope y'all can hear me. Can you hear me back there?
Stand up.
No? All right, I'll stand up. Right. Great. So I can... really humiliate myself. Isn't she awesome?
Yeah.
I'm going to start by being honest, just to like get this out of the way before I, you know, launch into my tragic tale. Because my evil sponsor has forced me to go to step 6 and 11 recently. You know, and I looked at some character defects that I wasn't aware of. Or actually, I was aware of them, but I kind of thought they were part of my personality. I really want you all to like me. Okay? So, really want you all to like me. I want you to laugh. I want to entertain you. I'm very glib. I'm very ironic, which gets in the way of this thing that we do called communicating. And so, you know, that said, you know, and I want you to think I'm really cool. That said, I mean, that out of the way, I'm sort of hoping that I've just kind of either taken the piss out of myself or, you know, kind of put a hex on all those things for the next 40 minutes. So hopefully, you know, I won't let that kind of stuff interfere with, you know, my story. My story begins. I would have to say, you know, there's a family. I don't know if you guys can relate to this, but usually there's one family in the neighborhood that thinks they're like kind of grander than everybody else. You know, it's like that would be my family. I mean, we were like regular working. It's taken me years to get to this, so it's like we were regular working class stiffs. But the way we were raised, you would have thought we were like, you know, Mellons or Kennedys. Or something. You know, it's like completely just this delusional, you know, grandeur, which was very useful because the thing was, my dad was an active alcoholic. The setup is this basically: it's my maternal grandparents were out, they put away a fifth every night between the two of them. My grandmother used to distinguish herself by throwing up at the dinner table during Thanksgiving. Now, mind you, she did this on a cashmere sweater set, so it all looked fine. They lived in mainline Philadelphia, very nice suburbs, you know. When I got older, I used to go visit my grandma every month. Before I went away to school, I would visit my grandma. And everybody thought I was such a nice grandson. What they didn't know was that grandma had the best medicine cabinet in the Northeast. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it was real, just anything that you wanted, you know. Of that time, I mean, we're like comfortably in the 70s at the moment. So we're talking Quaaludes, Valiums, you know, all that, you know, disco drugs. And so I would just, you know, put them into, you know, a giant bag and sling it over my shoulder. And of course, she never was the wiser because she was always like, you know, checked out anyway. So, you know, it's funny because when I talk to my partner, I tell my partner about who I was, you know, he kind of says, God, you know, I don't think I would have liked you much. And I said, well, you know, really, that's funny because I didn't like me much either. And I would really not like me much now. Okay, so that's my mom's side of the family. My dad grew up in a completely dry household. His mother wouldn't allow any wine or anything, you know, past the front door. Well, come to find out later, they were from a big, huge Irish family on the New York border with Canada. And before AA, really. And it was a way to inoculate themselves against what they saw happening to their brothers and sisters. So, you know, it's sort of a drunk drug addict dynasty. You know, it's like, so, you know, my mom was like a complete control freak, and my dad was like one of those Jekyll and Hyde kind of drunks. So it wasn't like, he wouldn't get all slurry and passed out and sing or anything, or, you know, beat my mom up or anything like that. He would just go from being like a really nice, sort of unassuming, great guy into being like King Dick. I mean, just a fucking dick. You know, and it's kind of funny because, you know, I've talked to friends of mine, you know, from that period. You know, they say, yeah, your old man used to just, you know, take you apart. And I wasn't aware of this. You know, so anyway, you know, cut to, it kind of, you turn into, as some of us know, you know, you never know what's going to meet you when you come through the door from school. You know, it could be, oh, hi, bake some cookies, or get to your room this instant and wait till your father gets up. You know, it was, were you going to get Jekyll? Were you going to get Hyde? We don't know, you know. And so, you know, it kept my sister and I on our toes. Anyway, you know, what happened was, I mean, I was a pretty bright kid. You know, yeah, I was kind of one of those kids that, like, you see out with your parents in a shopping mall or something, and they're, like, kind of precocious and really annoying, and you kind of feel bad for them, but you really don't want to, like, be around them. You know, it's like, I look at kids like that, and I go, oh, man, that's me. You know, and my heart goes out to them. I just remember, you know, my first emotional memory, mine was anxiety. And really, I kind of grew up, like, wanting to be just about anybody but me. Even at a very young age, when I shouldn't have even, you know, known, but, you know. So anyway, what happened was I was born on the East Coast, and then when I was 8, we moved to the Deep South. Mississippi, to be exact. And, so I went from Baltimore, which was, okay, not unlike Oakland, actually, you know, but, you know, it, you know, in tone as well, you know, progressive, kind of, you know, cool people and stuff like that. We moved to Mississippi in 1968. So we're talking, like, what, 3 years after they murdered all those kids, it was the Ku Klux Klan murdered the Freedom Riders and... You know, there was a lot going on. And so this was like a huge, you know, it was a huge adjustment on my part. So I dealt with it by, I found food abuse first. So, like, you know, I come in from school and, you know, I don't know if anybody here has done that, but... You know when the Oreo cookies used to come in a roll? And you could just, like, you know, pop open one and, like, you know... I just, you know, go through the whole stack, you know, with some milk and just, like, you know, get it in, you know? And, yeah, shut up. And, that comes later. And, not very much later. Shockingly, not much later. You know, so yeah, I started by abusing food, and I was like, fucking, just, I was so miserable. And the thing that's really interesting is, like, well, I'll sum it up for you. It's kind of like my mom. She went to go check on my progress in school with the teacher, with the nun. And she said the nun's summation of my progress was basically, Peter's a nice boy, but he doesn't play football. Peter was never going to play football. Peter was never going to play Smear the Queer, which was the other, you know, which was the other, that was the other game. We had two games at recess, Smear the Queer and football. Now, you know, you've heard me speak for about 5 minutes. Do I seem like a champion at Smear the Queer? Probably not. So, yeah, this is the kind of environment.
Just wait, old man.
So this was like, I was not a happy kid, you know, nor was my mother. My sister was like, sort of, my younger sister was kind of in oblivion. She's like still trying to forgive me for being the, like, the sort of the chosen child, you know. She was adopted, I wasn't. I was the smart one. She lives in a huge apartment in Manhattan and just bought a house in Savannah. Now you tell me who was the smart one. Okay, but anyway, I was the smart one. You know, she was like, yeah, Mom and Dad always paid so much attention to you and blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, let me tell you what that was like. You know, I mean, it's like I sort of had these parents that were like, when my father wasn't drunk and having a temper tantrum, and my mother wasn't, like, I don't know, freaking out and chain smoking. It was like they were overly involved in my life. I mean, it was like they were up my ass all the time. And so anyway, I mean, it was all very confusing to me. So anyway, you know, it wasn't a happy childhood. It wasn't a horrible childhood because there was a lot of stuff to do. I mean, I could go off in the woods, and I could fish, and I could, you know, crab, and, you know, get in boats, row boats, and, you know, ride my bike and go to the beach, which is kind of what I did, you know. Then my next-door neighbor, who was pretty hot, and 11. Calm down, I was 10. You know, introduced me to, you know, sexual activity, which was really awesome. And, you know, so that was, you know, so we were kind of off to the races with that. And I would have to say, I mean, I'll, you know, sort of come clean and, you know, just basically say that my first full-on sexual activity was with another boy when I was 12. And, you know, like, we went all the way. And I remember thinking, I got to really make this count because, like, I'm going to hell now. We were Catholic, and so were my friends with benefits. I still haven't been able to piece. I don't know whether it was because it was the South or because we lived by a really big air base. I've talked to other people about this, and I'm like, yeah. So you had? Oh, you didn't really. Oh, well, okay then. You know, my partner, you know, held out till, you know, a reasonable, you know, time. Most people I know usually did. But anyway, so yeah, I got, I forgot the part about getting molested in the Boy Scouts. But anyway, you know, 12, it was like one of my friends, like, we stole his brother's pot. And that was my first, you know, that was my first sort of foray into, like, you know, wanting to change my mood. And it wasn't like I even knew, you know, and pot was, we're talking like a long time ago. We're talking like 1972. Pot is not even remotely legal. You know, it's not even like, most people don't even think it's even okay. You know, the people who thought pot was okay were like, this many people, and the people who thought it was like, it might as well be rat poison or heroin, was this many people. So, you know, and, you know, you were really getting exposed to a lot of what they would call drug education at that point, but, you know, but was basically telling you that, you know, you smoke weed and you're going to rip off all your clothes and jump out a window, and, or, you know, kill your mom with a chainsaw or something. And, you know, I had no experience to base it on, but I was still willing to take the risk. And the reason I was willing to take the risk was because I just really wanted to be anything, anybody but who I was, and I wanted to feel anything but what I was feeling. And I just, you know, it was like, oh, get me out of here, you know. So fire it up. So, you know, that was the deal. I should go back and I should point out that the way my household, my dad used to, he would go to these meetings when my mom would like manage to like browbeat him into it. So it was like he would disappear some nights of the week sometimes and go to this meeting. And I had no idea what this meeting was about. You know, it was like, and actually I had a close friend in high school, and, you know, we both kind of thought, you know, speaking about it much later, we kind of thought maybe it was where all the parents in the neighborhood would get together and go, well, you know, Peter wasn't good today, and, you know, he didn't do well on his math test, and, you know, because the world revolves around us. But, you know, so that would happen, and I kind of didn't get the whole deal, but 12 was like a big turning point for me. So I was kind of fascinated because alcohol also played a very different role. Like, you would watch, like, TV, and getting drunk was very funny. You know, and you'd watch like a situation comedy, you know, Beverly Hillbillies or Bewitched or something, and I know that half of you have no fucking idea. I think the Cartoon Network or something has them now. They're pretty funny, actually. But, you know, I didn't understand why none of this went on in my house, you know. We had a liquor cabinet, you know, but anyway, it was... So that was the deal. So Dad went to meetings, and Mom, like, flipped out most of the time. And I decided to sort of try some stuff from her medicine cabinet just to see if it would do anything. God only knows what I was, like, ingesting. I mean, you know, it could have been birth control pills for me. But anyway, you know, I was just curious. 12 was, like, a weird year for me, though. It was, like, I was molested. I had sex for the first time. I started drinking and doing drugs. I started smoking. And I think there was one other thing I can't remember. I found out why my father went to meetings and didn't drink. And the way I found out, our house was situated in a way that there was a vacant lot between our house and the next door house. You know, Mississippi in those days, probably still is, was the kind of place that you would... Are you telling me to wrap it up, or...? Oh, okay. you know, in those, it wasn't the cleanest state in the... You know, there wasn't a litter concept. It was kind of like, you finished something, you threw it out the window, you threw it out in your car, you threw it out the truck, you know, whatever you wanted. So there's this vacant lot, this wooded lot between our house and next door that was... lots of beer cans. Tons of beer cans. Beer cans all the time. So anyway, you know, I finally figured out, I was spying on my dad. He, you know, he kept like, he was barbecuing and he kept sending me into the house for like really stupid shit. Oh, go get me an egg. We're grilling an egg. Okay, whatever. Finally I spied on him, you know, and he was like, I mean, I gotta say, my old man could really suck it down. He was like, you know, he'd kill a six and then, like, scatter it to the wind over the vacant lot. Pretty clever. So I kind of figured out that was when I got, you know, nobody bothered, you know, because in our family, you didn't involve children in reality because we were so sheltered. So, you know, it's like I had my life, my parents had theirs. They didn't know about mine and, you know. And they went to their graves not knowing about mine. But anyway, so cut to, we move again. So we move from this really small town in Mississippi to a town in New Jersey near the shore that was like, well, it was like, y'all seen that show Jersey Shore? Yeah, well, now picture, okay, so I'm going to high, I'm in my second year of high school, and picture those kids without the steroids, the hair gel, or the tans. or the fake boobs, okay? So all you've got is their core personality. So I go from this, you know, I go from the Deep South and I get thrust into this school and I'm like, I have no clue. I go from a Catholic school of 250 boys to a school of 1,700 Guidos. I don't know what to do with myself. So, you know, I do drugs. So, you know, it was just basically, I mean, I was like a smart kid, but, you know, I hung out with, like, there was the dirtbag clique. And that's always kind of where I gravitated towards. You know, it was like the rednecks, the dirtbags, whatever. You know, so, and again, it was just because I didn't want to be smart. I didn't want to be creative. I didn't want to do any of those things. So fast forward. Finally, I go to college, and you know, I mean, it's the same. We all know what it is, and it's the same old thing. It progresses, and in college, I learned how to shoot coke. I learned how to shoot heroin. I learned, you know, got myself good and strung out. Dropped out a few times. Worked at Merrill Lynch. You can imagine how well that worked out. While high. Had no idea. Finally, I get, you know, 24, I'm hitting bottom. It's like, I decide, you know, my life is just, there's nothing wrong with my life that I can discern. It's not like I'm killing people. You know, I'm not breaking into people's houses or, like, stealing TV sets or anything like that. I had a job, you know, in publishing in New York City. But I just wasn't going anywhere. And so I figured I'd try to quit the drugs. So I tried to quit the drugs. I can't quit the drugs. I didn't really have, like, a really bad habit. Well, I did have a bad habit. What I didn't have was, I never was one of those drug addicts who had, like, that, you know, I have to shoot 10 bags by 8 a.m. or I get sick. It was not like that. What I had was like a really good chip. And, you know, the thing that got me in, and I'll be getting to, like, the thing that got me in was my abject boredom. So I go to this meeting, I go to this crazy meeting, so this is in New York City, on St. Mark's Place, and I was so terrified of everyone because they were these really loud, raucous, you know, crazy meetings with all, like, crazy people and stuff. And, you know, anyway, so, like, my first 2 weeks of sobriety, when I finally, it took me about 6 months, I kept coming back, it took about 6 months to get, like, 90 days. And within, like, 2 weeks, I was, like, canned from my job. I never lost a job until I got sober. You know? I have some tips for you. You're not your job. You're not what you're wearing. You're not what you do for a living. You're not where you live. You're not the car you're driving. You know, you're none of those things. No matter how often society tells you, you are. You're not. And unless you can let go of that stuff, you will never be able to do this program. Anyway, what it's like now, I should probably wrap it up. My point is that what happened was when I was new, when I got my 90 days, you know, I did the test. I'll give it 90 days. I'll do it the way you guys say to do it. Which took some real doing on my part because I'm incredibly intelligent and I know everything. Except I couldn't seem to give up dope or alcohol. And, you know, and I thought, and what I did was when I was active, I told myself this was all a big adventure. You know, like going into shooting galleries and sharing needles was like a big adventure. Getting treated for Hep C is a really big adventure, let me tell you. But it's like, you know, I got what I needed. Now, what I needed at the time was a really sort of glam, kind of glitzy, like, New York experience. I went to this meeting that was like, my home group was this meeting that was like the first meeting in New York that was a cross-addicted, they encouraged discussion of drugs as well as alcohol. So what we had was a bunch of people who were like, we had a bunch of artists, we had a bunch of fashion designers, we had a bunch of, you know, kind of rock stars, writers, all this kind of stuff, because, you know, at that point in time, it was like, nobody just drinks at this point. Everybody uses, you know, whatever is around and whatever will work. At least that's what I did. And, you know, I know one or two people that were exclusively alcoholics, but in my experience, that's fairly unusual. Anyway, I would like to say that I was really attracted to the, you know, the good sobriety in that room and everything else. And there was some good sobriety, to be sure. But what I was really attracted to was seeing all these famous people in the rooms. What was really hard was not telling anyone. You know, be like, I go home and I say to my roommate, like, oh my God, you'll never believe who was in the meeting tonight. She's like, who? And I'd be, I can't tell you. And I think that's something really important in AA. There's a lot of people who feel that, you know, they have no shame about their recovery, and I think that's really great. I have no shame about my recovery, but I don't want to represent this entire organization. I don't want to represent, because I can be an asshole. And if somebody outside sees me, you know, like a civilian, sees me being an asshole, it's like they assume that from my behavior, if they know that I come here, they're going to think that you're all assholes and that it doesn't work, because they don't understand that it's Alcoholics Anonymous, not Assholes Anonymous. Because I've been a really major asshole. What happened was that my life got far more interesting once I actually put the drink and the drugs down. And, you know, if I'm a good boy and I work hard, December 9th of this year, I'll have 30 years. Which is like, I can't believe I have 30 years. I can't believe I'm that old. I can't believe I'm alive. You know, it's kind of funny because I've had a lot of really cool situations in my life that, you know, made me feel really valuable and worthwhile and important and validated. And a year and a half ago, my partner and I moved up here for an opportunity, a career opportunity for him. And, you know, it's like, and I had a really hard time finding employment. And the thing is, I've had to kind of, and it's been actually in a way really good for me, because, you know, I've had some hot shit jobs, you know, in Los Angeles, in New York. It's like, the Bay Area could give a shit, apparently. And occasionally I feel like calling some of these prospective employers up and going, you don't even want to meet me? Come on. You know, and in some cases, I actually have a healthy enough ego to think that I'm justified. But, you know, the point is that I've had to go back to, I'm not my job, I'm not my salary, I'm not my clothes, you know, I'm not my car, I am actually an Uber driver. And that's what I do to make money right now, because I need to make money and I need to be productive, and I wasn't for an entire year. And, you know, so it's like, you know, and this is not to make you think I'm like, you know, important, or and probably don't even know who I'm talking about. But, you know, I mean, at one point, you know, it's like I got my name into like the newspaper, you know, it was like, you know, Liz Smith and like, you know, the columns in New York, you know. And the thing is, it doesn't mean anything out here, but it's like in New York, it's like gossip columns are like life's blood. I mean, you know, it's like everybody reads all the gossip, you know, every day. And it's not the same thing as like the Chronicle, which does like society. This is like dirt and parties and all kinds of bullshit. And to get your name in one of these things back there is real currency. It makes you hot shit. It doesn't work here. But but my point is, it's, you know, there's been times in my sobriety when I felt like, yeah, I am it. Well, at the moment, you know, I actually am not it. But what's kind of funny is that I am kind of it. Because I have a really great life, and I have a great partner, and I have two really ill-mannered dogs. And, and I have my sobriety, and I have my self-respect. And the thing is, and I have met some really wonderful people in this room, not you. And, the jury's still out on you. And you know, the thing that's great is I don't know where I would be right now without this. You know? And you know, you kind of think to yourself, you know, I don't need to do this. You know, it's like people have asked me, oh, do you still go to those meetings? And it always makes me laugh. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I have no idea why. You know, but I guess it's kind of a compliment coming from somebody who doesn't understand this disease, nor do they have it. They must think that I'm better. You know? Yeah, well, which is good. And I'll let them think that I'm better, you know, because I don't have to get into the whole explanation. What I want to say at this point is, like, are we almost done yet? God.
15 minutes.
Okay, here's what I want to say. If you're new, keep coming back. If you fuck up, keep coming back. If you're afraid that, you know, everybody's going to talk shit about you, fuck them. Keep coming back. Because I'll tell you something. The people, I've seen this. The people that have the most to say about people who, you know, can't get a lot of time, they're the ones who end up using themselves because they're not in a good place. You know, they're not in a good place. They don't come from love. They come from fear. They see you having a hard time. They're afraid. You don't have to listen to them. You just keep coming back. I've been to a lot of one anniversary parties, you know, first anniversary parties that in LA, because in LA you parties, cakes, it's, you know, that's how we roll down there. And it's not a bad way to roll. It's kind of fun. But, you know, I've seen a lot of people who take 10 years to get 1 year. You know, and it's like you should never let somebody put you off getting this. Because it's basically you're allowing somebody to, like, not let you save your own life. You know, I have dear friends that have hard times putting time together. It's like, I don't judge them because I'm not them. I don't think I'm better than you because I have a lot of time, because I'm an old timer at this point, which is really disgusting. But anyway, it's like, I don't. I'm really lucky. And I had a lot of help. And I met a lot of great people in the rooms. It's like, I've had a million slips. I just haven't picked up. And when I say slips, I've had bad attitude slips. I've had bad program slips where I'm not working the steps. I'm lazy. I'm, like, complacent. I'm full of my own shit. And it's like, you know, the only thing that's good is that, and I really believe this too, it's like, you want to do something? If you can stay sober doing it, go right ahead. I'm not saying, don't kill anybody or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, my life didn't really get interesting until I stopped using. Then it got really interesting and in ways that I'm not going to go into. But, because that's a whole other share. But, you know, I have no regrets. It's like there's been a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of really sad stuff that's happened. There's been a lot of really great stuff that happened. there's been a lot of insanely fun shit that's happened. And, you know, the thing was that, and some of it, not very wise. But, you know, hey. You know, I was young, I was impetuous at one point. And, I'm glad I did. I mean, I have no regrets about anything I did, except, you know, if I, like, you know, I've come to a deeper understanding of, like, you know, men are predators. And you know what? A lot of times they don't know that they're predators. And I was one of those men. And it's like I didn't realize until later that, like, you know, sometimes, you know, you let the little head do the thinking for the big one. Pardon me. And, you know, this is something we kind of learn how to get past here. You know, so there's a lot of times when, you know, I kind of reduce people to, like, targets rather than seeing them for fully formed human beings. You know, and, you know, yeah, I'm sorry about that, you know. Because, you know, we all deserve better. And I deserve better. And that's pretty much, I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, I wish I had some really huge, you know, like, I wish I was one of those people who shares these really, you know, sort of good, seamless, you know, stories. Yeah, I probably should have done some notes, but my partner said, oh, don't worry, it'll be fine. It's his fault. So it's his fault. But, you know, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for, you know, keeping me sober and letting me share and for being in my life. And, you know, and I hope, you know, I kind of have always been moved by that line. And it's so corny, but, you know, and I kind of hate myself for it. But, you know, it is kind of nice to think that we will all meet each other trudging the road of happy destiny. Thanks a lot. Thank you.